evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, July 18th, 2018. President Kiir fires his foreign minister 7 months after he failed to return from another country.
I felt that I was being humiliated, and I did not accept any humiliation from anybody. Since if the president wanted the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he better takes it over.
And there's no power-sharing deal in Khartoum.
Some few members from SOHA were saying that's not what they want. They want to see a very small lean. And also the government was saying they want to see it in a manner that it's reflecting the Entebbe proposals.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan President Salva Kiir has fired his foreign minister, Deng Alor, saying he has been absent from the office since December of last year. The president issued a decree on Tuesday replacing Alor with Nial Deng Nial, his former advisor on foreign affairs. One political analyst says the presidential decree is meaningless because Alor was no longer interested in serving Kiir. The president fired Alor as foreign affairs minister in a decree announced on South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation last night and appointed Nial, a former advisor and the government's chief negotiator, at peace talks. Deng Alor is one of the 11 former political detainees who was appointed foreign affairs minister in the transitional government of national unity as part of the power-sharing deal in 2015, which later collapsed. According to the 2015 agreement, if President Kiir is not happy with Alor's performance, he's supposed to appoint another member of the former detainees' delegation to serve as minister. Deng traveled to Addis in December of last year as a former detainee delegate at the talks and at that time decided to remain in Addis. In May, Alor told South Sudan in Focus he left Juba because the peace deal was not implemented and he felt uncomfortable working as the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
I felt that I was being humiliated, and I did not accept any humiliation from anybody. Since if the president wanted the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he better takes it over.
Alor said Juba failed to implement the 2015 peace deal and claimed President Kiir made life difficult for him at the ministry.
The president also interfered with the day-to-day of the business of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, appointing and deploying very junior staff without the information of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. The ministry was being run directly from the office of the president. So I felt, I said, what am I doing here? I have business. I have no business if the Minister of Foreign Affairs is being run directly from the office of the president and is being run by other ministers, whether Minister of Cabinet Affairs or other ministers. So I felt I did not have a job to do. I better go and rest and do some other things. And I said, the president can go ahead and dismiss me because I can't continue in this environment.
South Sudanese political analyst James Akuk says Alor's dismissal is long overdue.
The president of the republic was patient to bear with him, but he was supposed to be fired maybe 3 months ago, not now after 5 months, but at least finally, the president decided to fill the vacuum that he has left in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
And Cook says Nial is capable of performing the duties of foreign affairs minister, that is, and hopes Deng will carry out some much-needed reforms on South Sudan's foreign policy, which he says has lost credibility.
Nial is somebody who is experienced in the field of diplomacy and international relations, and he has worked in that field since the liberation time. And he was also the pioneer of the Ministry of Regional Cooperation during the time of the CPA. And again, he was also the Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation after our independence. So he knows that ministry in and out, and he's one of the tough diplomats of South Sudan in the international arena.
Okuk says the 2015 peace deal is no longer relevant, and President Kiir is moving forward by appointing close allies into key positions. He says Niall's appointment comes at a tough time, though, when South Sudan's diplomatic ties are under siege. He says Niall has to change that situation. President Kiir's office says consultations were held with the former detainees for Alor's replacement, but claims that no member of the former detainees was willing to take over. That report was prepared by Demo Silva Aurelio in Juba. The South Sudanese warring parties meeting in Khartoum have not agreed on a power-sharing plan. South Sudan's information minister says the government agreed to have five vice presidents, including a first vice president, but opposition members rejected that arrangement. A religious leader at the talks who praised Sudan for helping the parties reach a deal on some issues says if Sudan cannot get the parties to compromise on power sharing, it should hand over the process to the Kenyan government. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The South Sudan Opposition Alliance has rejected a draft power sharing proposal under which South Sudan would have four vice presidents and one first vice president. The proposal also reduced the number of ministries from 45 to 35 and recommends dissolving the current Transitional National Legislative Assembly and replacing it with a new one composed of 550 members. Edmond Yakani, a member of civil society delegates at the negotiation, says the draft proposal was distributed to the parties 2 days ago but was opposed by some of the warring parties.
There are those who welcome it, there are those who rejected it, in terms of whether those can be individual party or those can be alliance in a party. Some few members from Sohawa are saying that's not what they want. They want to see a very small lean. And also the government was saying they want to see it in a manner that it's reflecting the Entebbe proposal.
Yakani says the warring parties are not able to reach to a deal on governance issues because of lack of trust and not enough willingness to compromise. He says the parties are not ready to agree because many of their members are putting their personal interests first.
You bring for them draft, the first thing they ask is the numbers. What are the numbers? How is the numbers distributed? The numbers are not okay, regardless of whether those numbers can help. Because even if you have the great number, if there's no political will to implement, what will these numbers make? This experience I've really learned through my participation in the high-level revitalization, right from day one until today, I come to realize that politics of numbers is very strong among political elites of South Sudan.
Bishop Enoch Tombe, who represents the South Sudan Council of Churches at the talks, commends Sudan for pushing the warring parties to agree on other issues. He says, given the social, political, and historical ties between the two countries, he believes Sudan will bring peace to South Sudan.
They really work hard. Within a short time, they have achieved 2.5 agreements. The Khartoum Declaration, 27th of June, and then the second one is the Security Arrangements and Permanent Ceasefire Agreement. And now they're really working hard to finish the work, the remaining work on the governance agreement. I've seen the draft is quite good, I must say.
Several sources among the Sudanese mediation team say South Sudan's parties may still sign an agreement tomorrow on power sharing. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwei, a member of the government delegation at the talks, says the government will not sign any agreement that fails to include the Entebbe power-sharing proposal.
It is clear that it will not be possible for the government of South Sudan to sign such an agreement, because if we sign it, this agreement will be worse than even the agreement which we are trying to revitalize now.
Makwei says other provisions which have tempered with Entebbe agreement are subject to more negotiation. He says if the parties do not reach agreement on power sharing, another summit should be arranged so that the remaining outstanding issues are resolved.
In case of any change in the provisions of the Entebbe agreement, that change cannot be done by anybody other than to call another summit to come and review, to go and review that. As to where it will be sitting is open to the mediators to decide where it should be held.
The IGAD Council of Ministers mandated that Sudan President Omar al-Bashir continues with face-to-face talks between President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in Khartoum. The warring parties are expected to continue negotiating in Kenya, but no dates have been announced for for another round of talks in Kenya. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The South Sudan government summoned the French ambassador to South Sudan yesterday over remarks he made in which he condemned government forces for killing civilians in Lir and Mayandit counties of Lish State and committing other atrocities, according to a recent United Nations report. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan's undersecretary at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Baka Valentino Wall, calls the statement made by French ambassador Zone V undiplomatic and says he summoned Zone to explain his public remarks that South Sudanese officials were late to believe we are going to about something else.
Instead of talking about the good things about independence of France, he chose to talk about a report that was produced by the UN. He specifically asserted that in May and April this year, the government soldiers have attacked in Lair and Mayandit, and they have killed civilians, over 200 of them, including children, and that government soldiers have raped women.
Those details were included in the UN report widely reported by international media last week. Wall says the French ambassador made the comments during a celebration of France's National Day over the weekend in the capital, Juba. Wall says in his remarks, Ambassador Zone challenged some customary traditions in South Sudan.
He even went as far as talking about our culture and our heritage. Women's rights in South Sudan are abused, not just in relation to rape, but that they are deprived from inheritance when their husband pass, and that domestic violence in South Sudan is normal, and he should not even talk about it because it has become so normal. He even talked about the South Sudan customary laws as backward, and he even appealed to the activists that people should work to change our laws.
South Sudan in Focus made attempts to speak with the Zone on Tuesday but was unsuccessful. Patrick Bozo, the first counselor at the French embassy in Juba, says he was not aware that Ambassador Zone was summoned by the South Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs and declined to comment. The UN Human Rights Report accused the government forces of killing at least 236 civilians and of raping 120 women and girls in Lier and Mayandit counties in southern Lech State between April and May. The USAID-funded iRadio in Juba quoted Zone as saying, "Shooting women and children in the back while fleeing into swamps, is it a self-defense? No, it's a murder, raping. And killing lactating mothers, is it fighting criminals? No, it's committing a crime. So which political leaders could come to us today and say that was done on my behalf to serve the cause? There is no cause in this. It's committing a crime." End of quote. Calling the French diplomat's remarks uncalled for, Wall says he issued a letter of protest with the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
"We have told him in the strongest term possible that what he did was wrong. We have given to him a protest note, not a protest note addressed to him, but a protest note addressed to the Minister of Foreign Affairs of France and the government of France, and we are advising his government to advise him to desist from such undiplomatic practices."
In a news conference last week, the SPLA spokesman, Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwang, denied the accusations in the report. The decision to summon the French ambassador comes days later after the UN Security Council imposed arms embargo on South Sudan. France is among the nine countries that voted in favor of the resolution. Five member countries abstained. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's official. The first flights in years between Eritrea and Ethiopia happened today. Find out the mood at the Eritrea airport when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should men and women be able to inherit property equally.
Men and women, they have the same rights. Because these are rights. And I think rights implies to any human being.
Yeah, men and women should be able to inherit property equally because we all both have the same rights. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or you're a woman.
I think, yes, they have to inherit property equally because even when it comes to religion aspect, both men and women are equal. So I don't see the point whereby men should inherit more than women.
Men and women can inherit all the properties equally, but it again based on the cultural setting of every community.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It was a joyous atmosphere today at Asmara's International Airport as the first two passenger planes from Addis Ababa in 20 years arrived. The flights are among the rapid steps to rebuild the relationship between Eritrea and Ethiopia, a relationship severed in a war that began in 1998. Among the passengers was Ethiopia's former Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn. VOA's Tewelda Wolde Gabriel was at the airport in Asmara when the flights landed and describes the scene to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson as the planes landed.
The mood was very exciting early on. Earlier on in the morning, residents of the capital Asmara showed up at the airport, decorated with traditional dresses, holding banners, flags of Ethiopia and Eritrea, singing the traditional song. Then just before noon, the first plane just arrived. The former Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Hailemariam Desalegn, embarked along with the CEO of Ethiopian Airlines. And this group was welcomed by Eritrean Foreign Minister Osman Saleh and Eritrean Airlines officials.
There were two planes instead of just one. Why was that?
The first plane, which is bigger, I believe it's 787, was carrying officials and investors or business people only. These are, especially the investors, these are investors that they came here in Eritrea to look at possibilities of investing or buying shares in Eritrean economy. The second one was just carrying ordinary people, just guests. And these guests include not only Ethiopians, but also Eritreans who were separated from their families. So it was kind of very emotional, especially for these separated families when they just came today on the second plane.
Now, you were talking to people there at the airport. What were people saying?
Everybody is saying we have not enough words to describe the happiness and the joy. So other than dancing and, singing and just happy, we are happy. We are more than happy. We have no words. Very happy to be here. And everybody was thanking God. Thanks, God. This happened. A dream came true.
Will the flights be daily, or do you know the schedule for the flights?
In the short plan, as far as the plan that is they schedule it, it's going to be daily. But I was also told that there is nothing like a permanent schedule for now. But tomorrow, another plane is coming, and guests from Eritrea also traveling back with the plane to Ethiopia. They have done the same today. Today, the second plane that was carrying the ordinary guests flew back to Ethiopia carrying guests.
That's reporter Tewelda Wolde Gabriel at the airport in Asmara today, speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. Kenya's Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife says yesterday a ninth black rhino has died after being relocated to a new sanctuary in a national park. The ministry says preliminary investigations indicate that the rhinos died of salt poisoning after drinking water with high salinity. Rael Ambour has the latest for VOA.
The latest black rhino death reported Tuesday brings the number of deaths in the Bush relocation operation to 9. Only 2 of the transplanted black rhinos remain in the new habitat at Tsavo East National Park. The Kenya Wildlife Service says the relocation was meant to establish a viable population in the new sanctuary and to safeguard the endangered species from poaching. A team led by Kenya's Police Investigative Unit will look into exactly what caused the deaths and how it happened and give a report in a week's time. Najib Balala is Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Tourism and Wildlife.
And the team that is going to lead the investigation will be a senior officer from the CID office, the Criminal Investigation Office. Then we will attach somebody from my office. There will be the University of Nairobi, the VET department. There'll be the VET department also at the Ministry of Agriculture.
Balala said the deaths were unprecedented in KWS operations, necessitating both external and independent investigations. The secretary showed photos of rhino horns he said belonged to the deceased animals to confirm that all the horns were secured by KWS after their death. Earlier, Kenyans on social media had voiced suspicion the rhinos were killed for their horns, which are coveted in Asia as status symbols for their mythical healing qualities. Balala said the 2 remaining rhinos in the park are being monitored closely.
We have confirmed this morning with the park management that they're in good health.
Rhino populations across Africa have dropped dramatically in recent years, mainly due to poachers. According to the Kenya Wildlife Service, Kenya had a rhino population of 1,258 as of 2017. This figure included 745 black rhinos. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africans engaged in all kinds of charity events today to mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela, the nation's first black president. On the centennial, Barack Obama, the first black U.S. president, met in Johannesburg with young leaders from across Africa. A day earlier, Obama delivered what might have been the strongest statements of his post-presidential life. VOA's Anita Powell has more.
It was the rhetorical punch that Barack Obama supporters had been waiting for him to deliver since he left office 18 months ago. In a wide-ranging speech commemorating Nelson Mandela's birth, Obama sketched a rosy picture of the progress and equality brought about by progressive leaders like the late Mandela, and then contrasted that with what Obama called today's strange and uncertain politics.
Strongman politics are ascendant, suddenly. Whereby elections and some pretense of democracy are maintained, the form of it, but those in power seek to undermine every institution or norm that gives democracy meaning. In the West, you've got far-right parties that oftentimes are based not just on platforms of protectionism and closed borders, but also on barely hidden racial nationalism.
John Stremlaw is a professor of international relations at the University of the Witwatersrand. He says Obama described an attractive alternative to the proliferation of right-wing politics.
I thought it was offering all of us a progressive alternative to the strongman autocratic tendencies that are showing themselves in too many countries of the world, including the United States. And for Barack Obama to embrace Mandela a day after Trump embraced Putin in Helsinki drew a very stark contrast, even though it was implicit.
Stremlaw was referring to the summit this week in Finland's capital between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. While Trump's name did not come up in Obama's 90-minute speech, the former president delivered a number of backhands, clearly aimed at his immediate predecessor, like this one.
Unfortunately, too much of politics today seems to reject the very concept of objective truth. People just make stuff up. They just make stuff up. We see the utter loss of shame among political leaders where they're caught in a lie and they just double down and they lie some more.
And this one.
Don't you get a sense sometimes, again, I'm ad-libbing here, that these people who are so intent on putting people down and puffing themselves up that they're small-hearted. That there's something they're just afraid of.
Politically, Strimla says Obama tried to strengthen two very different movements. That of new South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who took over after scandal-ridden President Jacob Zuma resigned in February, and of Obama's Democratic Party, which is trying to win back a congressional majority in midterm elections later this year.
I think its real significance is that what Obama was doing was outlining a strategy for the Democrats for the 18 congressional elections coming up. He's been relatively quiet, as you know, since he left the White House. This was his first major public address. And I like the idea that he gave such a substantive rationale for an approach to politics that is progressive but also intelligent and faithful to Mandela. But he could also just, you know, circulate that speech to all in the Democratic Party.
For all of his warnings, Obama urged those listening to hold on to hope and strenuously defend democracy. And, as if in reply, the crowd of 15,000 people who gathered in the cricket stadium in the bitter cold responded with a chant. Yes, they said, we can. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That is our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Maisha Di Batamu, which means Life is Sweet, by Sama Mapanoa. We've been listening to Samba Mapanoa with the song Maisha Ni Matamu, or Life is Sweet. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about our show at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.